Hello, does this sound good to everybody?
Yeah. Great, thank you all for coming to the fourth and final night of Dark Knights of the Universe. My name is Maya. I am the program manager at Recess, and I'm also on the committee for the public school. And these are the two groups that are co-presenting this series. We've been here gathering the last four nights, and it's exciting to see it reach conclusion tonight. And we also would like to invite you all to join us just down the street at Toad Hall. Just as kind of a wrap finale party, a chance to keep these conversations going.
It's a dark nightcap.
Yes. So we'll be gathering there about an hour and change after this class concludes. So you all are more than welcome to join us. Take it right out the door and you can't miss it. It's just on the next block. And then I'd also kindly like to ask everyone who's sitting kind of in this quadrant, if you wouldn't mind maybe just scooting back or this way in case we have some latecomers. So that they can have a nice space to just kind of scoot in. Thank you so much. And then I will pass up to Comey.
I'm Comey and I'm from the public school. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Nicola for, you know, proposing this whole series, and also to all the speakers, Dan, Eugene, and Alex, and also thank you Maya and Allison for having us here in Recess. Here's another public school member to you. So thank you very much. We're very excited and are still tripping out. So let me just read this really quickly about the public school. The public school believes that ideas shouldn't have to be monetized to be exchanged, so all of our classes are free and no one is paid. Our headquarters are in Greenpoint, so please consider making a contribution of any size to help contribute to 155 Freeman's expenses. There's actually beer back there, and you can put donations. We ask for like $3, so it's just right back there. So go there anytime. But thank you very much for coming. And here's Alex.
Okay, so just let me know if you can't hear me in the back. And having sat back there, I think it'll be fun because you'll be able to see the night slowly fall over the course of the next hour. So good evening to everyone. I want to acknowledge Recess and the public school for putting this on, and just remind any of you that, you know, the public school is a school with no curriculum, and if you want to propose a class to teach or to take, you can do it, which is what we did. So, and let me also just announce that with Kamomi's help, we've just released the free PDF, which you can download, which is the documentation of a class we did in October 2010, which actually Eugene and Nicola also contributed to. These five pamphlets devoted to French theory today, an introduction to possible futures. And Lauderwell is one of the five thinkers profiled in that publication. So you can download it now for free if you're interested. And I also want to acknowledge a name that that I don't think has been acknowledged so far, which is Miguel Abreu, who I think has probably done maybe more than anyone else in New York to sort of support and popularize the work of François Lauderwell. Miguel brought Lauderwell to New York last spring, and he's also helped to translate and publish a number of things, including the essay that is sort of the center of these four nights, on the Black universe in the human foundations of color, which he did way back in 1991 in a catalog that he produced for an exhibition at Thread Waxing Space. So as part of the Cascadia School, we are gathered together this weekend in dialogue with this text for four nights exploring mysticism and philosophy. The text has four parts, and we each took one part as a basis for commentary. Eugene, remote, the forgetting of the world. Eugene began with the terrain, the earth, a world created for us. But there is also the desert, and the desert leads to the universe. This is no longer a world for us, or a world in itself, Eugene reminded us, but a world without us. This is the universe, a place for hermits, not those who are incorruptible, but those who are absolutely corruptible. Daniel's talk, titled Wirelessness, The Universe is Deaf and Blind, he began, of course, at the beginning. In the beginning, there is black. But just as God separates light from dark, doesn't this mean that there is a common origin of white and black, he asked? Black is not so much the backdrop of creation, but an escape from the world, a why-less universe, a universe with no justification, a universe that cannot communicate, and thus is quite literally deaf, blind, mute, shut in. Nicola's talk last night was called Secret. No light has ever seen the black universe. And he spoke about the two axes of black, white, and dark, light, describing black in terms of a seizure of black emotion, a blackout, an epileptic emotion, he said. Black is the color that is not one. Yet, even if it is not one, perhaps somehow it can still be in one, as Lauderwell likes to put it. So the last section of Lauderwell's text is about rockets. So my title is Rocket, Present at Every Point of the Remote. And as you'll see, I'll be taking this as a cue to talk about Lauderwell's aesthetics, a mystical aesthetics. And I'll be quoting a lot from the text, as well as from another intriguing little Lauderwell essay from 1989 called Biography of the Eye. So I'll start with my most favorite Lauderwell quote. Inebriated and bastardized by Plato, liquefied and cogitated into concentrate by Descartes, moralized by Kant, whipped by Sade, devoured by Hegel, disgorged by Stirner, conscripted by Husserl, chewed out by Nietzsche, down the wrong pipe of Derrida, turned over by Heidegger, crapped out by Deleuze, thrown up by Lauderwell, and it would ask for more if we let it. So with this litany, François Laruelle recounts the many crimes of the philosophers caught in the clutches of their depraved profession. Philosophy is, in Laruelle's words, the oldest prejudice. To do philosophy means to harbor a secret stance toward the world, pursuing it, eating it, and digesting it, beating it down, then building it back up again. And philosophy itself is forever a glutton for punishment, eager to be re-enlisted for future abuses. It will always come back for more if we let it. Hang gliding, bungee jumping, ice climbing, Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, John Rambo. In a world of extreme sports and extreme weather, of supersized portions and long tails, is anyone really surprised by the advent of extreme philosophy? François Laruelle has arrived in America, but couldn't we see this coming? Like when the CIA funded the Afghani Mujahideen during the Cold War, only to have it come back to haunt them. We funded post-structuralism in the 1970s and 80s, and are today engulfed in the ultimate blowback. You planted the seeds of destruction, and Western metaphysics was shaken to its core. But nothing could have prepared you for what would come next. You thought Derrida was extreme, but you ain't seen nothing yet. Although Laruelle's so-called extreme position might not be that extreme after all. He simply refuses to participate. He refuses to make the decision. Like Bartleby's I Would Prefer Not To, or the Occupy movement's We Have No Demands, Laruelle refuses to participate in philosophy. Likewise, refusing all structures or relations that mimic the basic philosophical stance. But a refusal is not a withdrawal. That much is clear. Quote, philosophical technology has been withdrawn mimetically from the world in order to reflect and reproduce it, he writes in our text on the Black Universe. But such technology is inadequate for thinking the universe. Technology or science? The technology of rockets or cars is mere technology, not science. It merely provides an avenue for transit or mediation in and out of things. So too is philosophy a mere technology. If it were a science, it would remain immanent to itself, never transiting anywhere, nor needing to reflect on anything. For it would remain where it is, in the dark. But philosophy, always quick to prove its illuminating potential, is never in the dark. Quote, our philosophers are children, Laruelle reminds us. Children who are afraid of the dark. So forget your rocket ships and rocket cars. Leave behind the scaffolding of reflection and meditation. Do not think technology first, he says. Think science first. So I'll structure the talk around four recitations from the essay. This is the first one. Philosophy is thinking by way of a generalized black box. It is the effort to fit black into light and to push it back to the rear of the caverns. So can we maybe begin by listing some of the great explorations of black in art? Chief among them would be possibly Ad Reinhardt's black paintings, or some of Stan Brakhage's films with their murky darkness, or Guy Debord's notorious film Howl's Facade, which uses its blackness as a kind of weapon. But is the black screen in Debord truly black? If you were here, Larwell would point out that all these heroic avant-garde experiments are no more black than a bright summer day. As attempts to capture black, they are abject failures, and all the worse for trying to be so avant-garde, so utterly modern. For these meditations on the color black are quickly revealed to be what they are. Meditations. Black appears only in alternation with white, just as quietude is punctuated by noise, and immobile finitude by infinite mobility. The black screen in Debord's Howl's Facade is not black, but a black box. The film offers us blackness, but only in as much as the blackness can withdraw from other things, in this case, from whiteness or from the audible voice. So these are all works of alternation, you might say, of oscillation into and out of the black. Thus, they are properly labeled reflections on black, even howls for black, since black never appears in these artworks, only the optical alternations of black against white, black against color, or black against sound. So I'll read a quote from Deleuze where he explains this, I think, quite well. "The absence of image, the black screen or the white screen, have a decisive importance in contemporary cinema. They no longer have a simple function of punctuation, as if they marked a change, but enter into a dialectical relation between the image and its absence, and assume a properly structural value. Used in this way, the screen becomes the medium for variations. The black screen and the underexposed image, the intense blackness which lets us guess at dark volumes in process of being constituted, or the black marked by a fixed or moving luminous point, and all the combinations of black and fire, the white screen and the overexposed image, the milky image or the snowy image, whose dancing seeds are to take shape." So that was a long quote from Deleuze. So Reinhardt's paintings are the ultimate false lure, you might say. What appears at first glance to be black is quickly revealed to be a complex economy of micro shades of black, each with a different tone and luminosity. There is thus nothing black about these works, just as there is little silence in that notorious John Cage composition in which the musicians play no notes. Instead, they are works of division and alternation, of contrasted extremities, of absence appearing as presence and presence returning to absence. And hence, these are meditative works, reflective works, great metaphysical works, great philosophical works, even, but at the same time, only reflective, only philosophical. Quote, "Philosophers have divided up the undivided simplicity of the nothingness and the all," Larwell reminds us. "But Human eyes have never divided up the unique night. The universe is, in this sense, a night universe. And to look at the universe means to look into the darkness of the night. Vision is foundational when it abandons perception and sees in the night. In other words, vision is never vision with the lights on. Vision is only vision when it looks avidly into the pitch black of night. And perhaps art will never be art until it ceases to represent and begins to look into the Stygian monochrome, that blackness that has yet to be exposed to any living light. But, you might ask, is this all just another flavor of modern nihilism? Just another existentialism, you might even say. Here, Lauderwell answers no. Quote, "The philosophical eye wants to see the nothing in man's eye rather than see nothing. The philosopher wants to look man's nothingness in the eye rather than be a nothingness of vision." Nothing in man's eye versus seeing nothing. What is the difference? Recall those horrible nothing worlds of the existentialists. The existentialists can see man as nothing. The existentialists might even be able to see the world as nothing. But he cannot yet see nothing as nothing. Philosophers have long asked why there is something rather than nothing. For Aristotle, the question was always, why is there something rather than something else? For Nietzsche or Kierkegaard, it was, why is there nothing rather than something? But for Lauderwell, the question is poorly formed from the outset. For Lauderwell, the question might rather be, why, in looking at nothing, do we still never see nothing? For as Parmenides said, nothing comes from nothing. Quote, "Man is this middle between night and nothing, or rather less than this middle. Nothing which is only nothing, night which is only night." The second recitation. Science is the mode of thought in which black determines in the last instance white. Our euchromia, to learn to think from the point of view of black as what determines color in the last instance, rather than what limits it. Our euchromia, which is to say our non-chromia or non-color. What does this mean? As Lauderwell would say, color always has a position. Color always has a stance. The color palette, or the color spectrum, provide a complex field of difference and alternation. The primary colors reside in their determining positions, while other colors complement each other as contrasts. Hence, the color posture. Purple complementing yellow, red complementing green, the primary color's posture vis-a-vis the palette, and ultimately, the posture of color itself, governing the continuum of light and dark, as colors take turns emerging into a luminous and supersaturated visibility, or receding into a sunless gloom. Lauderwell uses photography as a way to explain these never-ending quests into and out of things. Platonism is perhaps born of the absence of a photo, he writes, proposing, I think, a rather provocative anachronism. Quote, from this we get the model and the copy and their common derivative in the simulacrum. Their common derivative in the simulacrum. And Leibniz and Kant alike, the intellectual depth of the phenomenon as much as its trenchant distinction, this is still a quote, find their possibility in this repression of photography. So Kant was repressing photography before the fact or something like that. Photography has long been held captive, forced to choose between two unappetizing options. Philosophy, on one hand, consciousness and reflection, and psychoanalysis on the other. The unconscious and the automatic drives. This is still a quote. The photo is then neither a mode of philosophical reflection, even if there is plenty of photography integrated into philosophy, nor a mode of unconscious representation or a return of the repressed. Neither being nor the other, neither consciousness nor the unconscious, neither the present nor the repressed. And I think there you can hear how Laruelle is not a post-structuralist, right? He doesn't fit into that tradition of French theory. Photography, then, which requires that light penetrate an aperture and right itself on a sensitive surface, resulting in prints, which in turn reflect light back to viewers, is an ideal candidate for Laruelle's intervention. Philosophy remains an optics, he writes. Quote, transcendental, no doubt, but specular. Intuitiveness is philosophy's unavoidable structure. The eye is first an external empirical sense. Then it is divided and doubled, the introduction of the other gaze constituting an a priori optical or specular field. Then the gazes knot themselves together, form a chiasmus, and constitute a transcendental speculative field. End quote. This is all what Laruelle seeks to avoid, of course. Using the language of optics, we could say that Laruelle exhibits an extreme dioptrics, in that he rejects absolutely the reduplication and extension of the eye in favor of an imminent transparency of identity. The multiplication of the eye into a recursive spiral does not suppress it, he reminds us. For the eye is the intuition that now gives the other eye, the gaze that opens upon the other gaze. Such is the kernel of all transcendental aesthetics. End quote. Is this not the great phenomenological gambit, that physiognomy is destiny, that our eyes and senses orient ourselves into a world toward phenomena which orient and reveal themselves back to us? So the philosopher says, we can see, so we must devote ourselves to seeing, and seeing well. Just as Heidegger said about thought, we are the creatures endowed with thought and the ability for self-knowledge. But, Heidegger says, even in this most thought-provoking time, we are still not thinking. The philosopher always asks, don't just look, try to really see. Don't just listen, try to really hear. As people often say, you're listening to me, but I don't think you really heard me. But Laruelle says, the decision is never between looking and seeing, or between listening and hearing. That is no decision at all. The true decision, the decision already made implicitly by philosophy, is to see and hear in the first place. We decide each time we open our eyes. In other words, photography is always understood as color photography, black and white photography, never black photography proper, you might say. Rather than these other color photographies, evident in everything from phenomenology to psychoanalysis, or you could say philosophy at large, Laruelle writes that we need a photography, now recast as non-photography, as science, or as what he calls identity. And if you remember, the Latin etymology of identity means same. So what would identity photography mean? Identity photography is black photography. And thus, identity photography is the only kind of photography that could leave an inscription of the black universe. Laruelle calls such photography, he calls this kind of photography a hyper-phenomenology of the real. It follows a logic of auto-impression, not expression. Not a, what you might call a cliché snapshot, but an imminent identity of the real. One does not photograph the world, the city, history, Laruelle reminds us. One photographs the identity of the real in the last instance. In this sense, while color always carries itself in terms of a posture, like we said before, or stance, black is immanent to itself, and thus can only be an in-stance, an instance, or, as Laruelle says, the last instance. Simplify color, says Laruelle. See black, think white. End quote. So don't see, be a seer. Stop seeing and start visioning. Be a visionary. Watchers and lookers are the ones who see white, who see the thing that they know they will always see. The one who sees black is the true clairvoyant. The black seer is the oracular prophet, what we call a medium. And hence, to understand media, or can we even say to do media theory, is to start visioning purely in the black universe. Never to see visions, never to hallucinate, for of course that is what philosophers do. Rather, to see vision. This is what Laruelle means when he says that vision, quote, abandons perception and sees in the night. And hence his deployment of that thorny, non-philosophical term of art, vision in one. Third recitation. The rocket passes through infinite distances. Let it jump over the cosmic barrier and enter into the hyperspace of the universe. Let your rockets become subjects of the universe and be present at every point of the remote. So Lauderwell's short text on the black universe, which we've been reading this whole weekend, was published in an issue of his journal called The Philosophical Decision, dated April 1988. Jesse, do you still have your copy? Since its inaugural issue, the journal was organized into two sections. A more or less straightforward opening section, followed by a shorter, more informal ending section called, I love this, Experimentation, Fiction, Hyperspeculation. So if the opening part of the of these journal issues maybe was a little more traditional in its attempt to grapple with philosophy from the point of view of this non-philosophical argumentation and analysis, the ending section was meant to feature actual examples of what it would mean to do non-philosophical writing, and some of them are really wild. On the Black Universe appeared in this hyper-speculative experimental section of the journal. And in that issue, it was bundled in the pages immediately after a 5-page letter to Deleuze, in which he scolds and castigates Deleuze on his treatment of Spinoza, and then proceeds to lecture him on the differences between philosophy and non-philosophy. And the Lauderwell joke, right, is that everything Lauderwell ever writes about is always called an introduction to non-philosophy. Right? So he says, you know, by philosophical decision, I mean, dot, 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 by real, I mean, by finite, I mean. But this 1988 letter to Deleuze was, of course, just a warm-up. A more thorough, quote, response to Deleuze appeared in 1995, outlining Lauderwell's rather dim opinion of his brother in eminence. For, of course, how could anyone with his name on the cover of a book called What is Philosophy ever come out alive? Deleuze and Guattari had mentioned Lauderwell briefly in that book, a reference most certainly intended by them, I think, as a kind of friendly tip of the hat to Lauderwell. Then, at best, a cult figure in France, and almost entirely unknown outside of France. But despite Deleuze's friendly intentions, Lauderwell considered it the lowest insult to be brought into the fold, if you will, for, as we know, Deleuze was a philosopher. Clearly, no good deed goes unpunished. A similar thing could be said, in fact, about Lauderwell's treatment of other figures, particularly Badiou, in his recent book, Anti-Badiou. Not subtle. And in this book, it's an exciting book because we have essentially the two most important living French theorists meeting head-to-head. Badiou, of course, the best-known, and Lauderwell, the least, you might say. And what results is a true disagreement, which is the first, I think, in a very long time. But if you read Anti-Badiou, don't expect the usual insults. Badiou as anachronistic Maoist, or Badiou as unrepentant Platonist. Because, of course, Lauderwell's dagger is sharper and more deadly, for he is Badiou the philosopher. So Lauderwell's squeamishness toward Deleuze aside, shall we not pose the question directly? Is Deleuze a friend of Lauderwell or not? Is Deleuze really a philosopher in Lauderwell's terms? We know that Lauderwell has always held Deleuze at arm's length. But in some senses, there are few other thinkers as close to Lauderwell. Right? And sometimes the people who are closest to you, you fend off all the more aggressively, right? Think of Deleuze, the philosophical realist, who so valiantly resists metaphysical logic. Think of Deleuze, the thinker of immanence, a deep commitment to immanence who that has been surpassed probably only by Michel Henry, and then of course surpassed eventually by Laruelle himself. In his book Cinema 2, The Time Image, which is Deleuze's book, if you remember, on the breakdown of cinematic representation after World War II, Deleuze introduces this interesting term, peaks of present. He introduces this as one of a handful of ways in which post-war cinema was able to suffer the collapse of the earlier visual schema and invent a new mode of vision in the ashes of the old. Now, he doesn't spend much time with the term, and he can't seem to dig up too many cinematic examples to flesh it out. He reverts actually to the work of Alain Robbe-Grillet, imported from literature, and then dwells for a time on Robbe-Grillet's collaboration with Alain René on the 1961 film Last Year at Marienbad. Yet in Robbe-Grillet, Deleuze sees a very specific treatment of time, a kind of pan-temporality in which all points of time are treated in terms of their own present, and then superimposed onto a simultaneity of presence. As with the pandemonium of all spirits, pandemonium, Robbe-Grillet produces a pan-chronology of all times merged together. Quote, a present of the future, a present of the present, and a present of the past. And I always wondered why most languages don't have a future-future tense, right? There's always a future-past, past-past, past-future. There's no future-future. For Deleuze, this produces a kind of vertigo, an indiscernibility that, quote, makes time frightening and inexplicable. Now, compare this pan-present to Laruelle's image of the rocket, a rocket which refuses to blast off or to land, but somehow flickers directly into the blackness of deep space. Quote, the rocket passes through infinite distances. Let your rockets become present at every point of the remote. So does Laruelle's present at every point of the remote have anything to do with Deleuze's present at every point of time? I think both yes and no. Yes, because they are both dealing with the virtual, which would be to borrow a word from Deleuze that, of course, Laruelle doesn't use. No, because Deleuze's pandemonium is a virtuality of time, while Laruelle's pandemonium is a virtuality of space. Or at least it appears to be space. We might expand the claim and make it slightly more pointed. A virtuality of fact. Deleuze says the virtual is real. Laruelle never quite says the real is virtual, but nevertheless the real, while remaining immanent to itself, is present at every point. And thus, in some basic sense, we might say virtual to every point. Further, Laruelle's real is never in a relationship with its virtualities. And thus, Laruelle will never speak in those Nietzschean tones of forces and counterforces so common in Deleuze. Action-reaction, actual-virtual, territorialization-deterritorialization. Our rockets may be present at every point of the remote, but in strict Laruellian terms, the story is slightly off. The remote, as real, is present unilaterally and ultimately at every point of the rocket. So the fourth and last recitation. Simplify color. See black, think white. See black rather than believe unconscious. And think white rather than believe conscious. So this brings us to the final lesson, that Laruelle's black is not simply a theory of the universe, but also a theory of the subject. What he calls the human, or the person. The Black universe allows for a mystical justice that is irreducible to either Christian morality on the one hand, or liberal ecumenicalism on the other. Quote, "All philosophical speculation is communication, and communication is always speculative," writes Larouelle, articulating what we now commonly call, thanks to Quentin Meyassou's popularization of it, the principle of correlationism. Of course, Larouelle is the original anti-correlationist. The correlationist logic is so troublesome, in the opinion of those like Larouelle and Meyassou, because it limits the discussion to one of two scenarios. Remember, this is about the subject. Either we speculate on or behalf of the other, or we speculate for or about ourselves. We're either reflective or introspective. We're either too nosy about others or too vain about ourselves. These are the two great maxims of philosophy. Quote, one, to see for itself by seeing in the place of the other. Two, an eye for an eye. This is why metaphysics is described by Larouelle in terms of vengeance. Either an eye for an eye, which of course is the symmetrical justice of retribution in the Old Testament, or what he calls, quote, eye for the other as hostage of the other eye. Which of course we can understand as a kind of universalization of liberal relativism, right? Where we promise to see for the other, or maybe even in our infinite wisdom, to step back and let the other try to see for itself. Either way, the eye is held hostage. Vision becomes a kind of vengeance, and vengeance is ours. Instead, the Black universe allows for a mystical subject, capable of a kind of mystical justice. Because it eliminates speculation. No more eye for an eye, and no more eye for the other. No more exchange of looks, and no more commerce in vision. Instead, an absolutely determined and unidirectional vision, a kind of visionary vision that looks without looking. So if you open your eyes partway, you see white. But if you open them all the way, you see black. Don't let the philosophers draw you out of the cavern and into the light, only to be dazzled by the first rays of the sun. But at the same time, don't douse the light and dig deeper into the abyss, in an attempt to spiral lower, darker, into your gloomy soul. Larouelle's human is one who opens its eyes in the night, not to look or speculate, but to know. Quote, "The night is this human, the human who does not speculate about man. Who am I, me who is? I am neither this reason nor this way of thinking, neither this question nor this speculation. I am this night." So I'll just end by repeating kind of the last couple of sentences that I gave last spring. Some of you might have been there when Larouelle visited here in New York. So hopefully it kind of ties all of these things together in a nice way. So this is the idea. If Paul recurs hermeneutics of suspicion framed critique as paranoia. And Deleuze and Guattari painted philosophy as schizophrenia. I think Laruelle renders non-philosophy as autism. Like an autistic child, we have difficulty communicating with the real. We cannot form real relationships directly with the one. Abstract philosophical concepts don't help us much. The one is absolutely foreclosed to us. Instead, we run alongside it, committed to its sameness. So if Deleuze's heroes are Spinoza, Hume, and the other philosophers of radical materialism, Laruelle descends from a different line, the autistic philosophy of Fichte with his self equals self, or Henri with his immanent ego. Some of you probably know that Laruelle has become quite interested in quantum mechanics in recent years, and he's particularly interested in this idea of quantum superposition, right? And maybe this informs this idea of autistic philosophy. Yes, I am autistic in a certain sense, he admitted last spring, like a particle that passes through a mountain. Next slide. So I think we have time for questions, and I also think that the other three speakers, I think it's kind of like open season. So I think we can all four of us just kind of respond in any fashion, or you could direct questions to any one of the four of us. And since I know nothing about mysticism, if it's a question about that, I will defer.
I was curious about trying to tease out the differences you were identifying between Laruelle's thinking and post-structuralism, and it seems to me that, it's hard for me from what I've been hearing to sort out the idea of, for example, this blackness as something that would be, not attainable simply through the negation of mm-hmm. what we see, and therefore as, kind of being a potentially, to a certain kind of thinking, impossible to access outside of binary thought sounds very to have an affinity to me with post-structuralism. So I was just wondering how to tease the two out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're right that both post-structuralism and Laruelle are interested in a very general sense, kind of not being sort of bound by these traditional dyads or these traditional binarisms. And so maybe if post-structuralism responds to it by, let's say, like proposing a kind of supplementarity, right, or a kind of excess, right, a kind of like extra part that then complicates the binary or something. Laruelle he comes from this tradition of sort of like the generic, right? So even in a kind of Marxian sense of species being, or more recently in the generic that you see in like Agamben or Badiou or even like Hart and Negri and other people. And so the logic there is not about this kind of supplementarity that undoes the binary, but it's about withdrawing from the act of like qualifying and describing things, right? So you actually lose qualities, you lose predicates, so much so that you, revert to some kind of state of the generic or something. And I think, I think the post-structuralists would just kind of like laugh at Laruelle or something, right? And be like, yeah, of course you think you can do that, right? But then there's this, we all know that secretly that's like a naive position or something. And I'm totally sympathetic to that critique. But I think, Laruelle would say like, no, you just withdraw from the decision to do that. Is that or do you want to follow up?
Well, I guess I was wondering in that sense of withdrawal, that was, I guess you kind of anticipated this, but that was my kind of immediate reaction to it, was just thinking the ways in which, you know, withdrawal and negation of predicates is determined by those predicates, and in that sense, and this is something that, you know, someone like Derrida will point out again and again, or even Heidegger, that, you know, abstaining is, you know, kind of a mode of being that stays within the play of those two.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's something to that, right, that the ascetic or the, you know, the monastic subject or something. I mean, it's kind of, we all of us have been kind of trying to adequately describe that, you know, that gives, you know, that is the most sympathetic description of Laruelle. But you're right, it's very tricky, right? Like, why is the hermit not just a kind of figure of negation or something, right? And I think the only way to understand Laruelle is that, it's not that. I hesitate in saying this, but I almost think that Laruelle has this kind of like weird sort of structuralism deep inside somewhere, where he sees, you know, he sees philosophical structures. So let's say like self and other. So the post-structuralist would say like, oh, well, the other complicates the relation to the self and so on, right? But Laruelle, he almost just takes that structure and puts it in like deep freeze until it's desiccated and dead, and it just is this kind of like non-human, like blank husk, right? And when it's completely annihilated of all human trace, right, then you can just take it as a dyad, and that becomes the data for non-philosophical science, right? And you say, like, okay, this is this weird structure of self-other, you know, and maybe there's like a data point that we can take from that. But yeah, it's hard. This is the endless Laruellian problem, which is that if you look at Laruelle from the perspective of philosophy, you'll never see non-philosophy. You have to just like dive in the deep end and kind of believe it first, you know, and then retroactively it might work or something. Yeah?
Hi. I was checking out the decision of philosophy, and the French isn't that good, so I'm not going to try, but... In the interview with Derrida, he was saying towards the end that philosophy is transcendental of science, and then later saying that in the same sentence that there's a black block. So science is a black block and a black transcendental of philosophy. Is that clear? Am I reading that? Or?
What's a black block?
Science for philosophy is a black transcendental and a black block, it's saying here.
I don't know. I might have to look at that. But
my question is that like a clone then? Is Laruelle going to use a clone if philosophy has a black transcendental and a black block? Does Laruelle then clone that for non-philosophy?
Yeah. I mean, that's in the parlance of non-philosophy. That's how it works. Laruelle thinks that sort of like science as it happens and philosophy as it happens sort of follow the same general kind of conceits and structures, and he thinks that those are almost like animals on the, you know, in the wild or something, right? And you can actually, you know, look at them in a scientific sense, and then extract these kind of data points from them or something, right? So yeah, they would be almost kind of like a black box or a kind of opaque thing that has to be, that you can't really participate in. You have to withdraw from that structure. Yeah.
I think the question requires clarifying what Laruelle typically means by science. We had some nice conversation about this in preparation for the event. And science, which normally means mean experimental technical science, versus the older meaning of science as scientia, knowledge.
Yeah.
Could you clarify maybe more?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that I can. So you know, there's two things that Lauderwill is trying to, like, avoid that are sort of scientific, you know, oriented towards science. One actually is analysis. Like, he sort of fantasizes about this idea of the pure a priori universe or something, which is kind of like an analytic universe, but he resists analysis, because analysis is, you know, what is analysis? Well, you break something down into its constituent parts, you, like, dissect something, and that's how you understand how it works, right? That you analyze. He doesn't want to do that. He also doesn't want to do synthesis, right? He doesn't want to have, like, two elements that come together and then produce, like, a third element that's different. So he has to resist these kinds of typical scientific methods, right? He has to resist some of these typical scientific methods. What he does instead is he says that what you can do is you can assert things axiomatically, and they're almost like groundless or something. That may not be the right way to put it, but the reason why he hates philosophy is he thinks philosophy wakes up in the morning and says, these are my foundations, you know, Eragonus, right? Like, presence is given to us. Okay, these are my foundations, and since I have now auto-positioned myself, now based on my foundations, I can say all these things as a philosopher, right? So Lauderwill says, don't do that. Don't auto-position yourself. Just come straight out of the gate and make absurd axioms, right? Or something, or like ungrounded axioms. And then after you do that, you can do any amount of like a priori conversion of those axioms. And it won't be synthetic. It'll just be purely what he calls it's a theorem. It's like theorematic, right? So I think that, does that help at all about the science he doesn't like and the science he does like?
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I just feel the affiliation between his understanding of science and like a medieval, early modern idea of science. And it evokes the age when, you know, science and philosophy are of a piece. That is, scientia just means the knowledge that comes through meditation and contemplation.
Wait, you mean they're of a piece so that Lauderwill can depart from them?
Science is an event, isn't it? It's an event of knowing in the human.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that is, it has to be understood, I think, as what's interesting about Lauderwill vis-a-vis mysticism is that he has this contemplative, just call it affect.
Yeah.
And the thinking through theorems, the thinking and the poetry of that kind of thought, the productivity of this risk, as we see in this
text. Yeah.
It's a form of risky thinking, but it's really not, it doesn't feel dangerously risky. It's not like a Nietzschean sort of leaping from peak to peak, you know, willing to fall, and it's very centered and permutative. That sense that you just explained, it moves, it's almost like, it's non-intuitive mystery.
Yeah.
It's not, well, I'm going to go with this and see where it takes me.
And he kind of resists his intuition. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, to me, that's, I think, a profound reinvention of what I recognize as a pre-modern.
Okay. I misunderstood. I thought you meant, early modern, like Descartes or something like that. Because he would totally reject.
That's a problem, yeah.
What?
Because I'm a medievalist.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is that you know, science before science pours itself to measurement. That's basically.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Well, what you brought up about the opposition to synthesis in Lauderwill's work.
He hates synthesis.
Resonated with what you said about the philosophical position having this kind of characteristic of the I of the other is a state of being hostage to the other's I.
Yeah.
And that itself seemed to kind of invoke a kind of a break with philosophy that goes, in terms of its political applications, that it goes further than just liberal ecumenicalism, because that exact situation is also very similar to the master-slave dialectic, mm-hmm. the relationship between
yeah.
Working class consciousness and bourgeois consciousness, and even the analysis of the gaze that Sartre engages in.
Yeah.
So it seems there you have like certain sort of fundamental ontological tenets about the way in which historical materialism operates that is also being called into question in Larwell's work. And at the same time, with his talk of heresy as this thing that breaks with something without completely, you know, undermining it or sweeping it out the door, there's a sense that he's also keeping aspects of the Marxist tradition alive as well. And given your work with Larwell, I'm just kind of wondering if you've thought about that so far in terms of what it actually means. Like, where do you go with that?
Yeah.
How does it apply?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. If you get rid of synthesis and you get rid of synthetic logics, right, you have to throw out the dialectic. It's kind of a big problem if you, like, are thinking about politics or something. You know, Deleuze throws out the dialectic, too. Larwell kind of, you know, goes much further, I think. But he's still a Marxist, or he considers himself a Marxist. And I think one of the things he takes from Marx is this idea of determination. It's his theory of causality. And he calls it determination in the last instance. And he gets it, you know, directly like from Marx through Althusser. And determination in the last instance, it's like Larwell's like sort of half autistic and half, it's like the one is sort of, it's kind of like a sadist one or something, right? it determines all of us in the last instance and never talk, you know, we can never fight back, we can never talk back, you know. And so he sort of takes that ultimate determination by the mode of production from Marx, and that replaces maybe what, you know, the dialectic, you know, used, a role that the dialectic used to play, maybe as a kind of historical cause. Yeah, that might be one way. Yeah.
Thanks. My question was whether you could say a little bit more about, I think the phrase was something like, when we photograph the identity of the real.
Yeah.
Because it reminded me a little bit, but almost like the opposite of a Lacanian or Heideggerian idea of there being real out there and things like clocks trying to fix the real, but just instruments that don't really. So, but it seemed like, is photography fixing the real? I just don't know.
Yeah, it's still unclear to me, honestly. I mean, there's, you know, Larwell doesn't have a lot of writing on aesthetics. There are a few things. I think actually one of the reasons why we're all drawn to this color piece is for that reason. So there's this great non-photography book. But the idea is, I think he sort of basically takes his idea of cloning and applies it to aesthetics and produces what you might call a realist aesthetics, which is doesn't really make any sense, right? Because if we think about aesthetics, we think about perception, which means we think about, like, you know, the human physiognomy and the human, you know, like, kind of correlation with the world, and we receive things and so on, we make judgments, right? These are the classic questions in aesthetics. But if you remove the human from the equation, well, how do you have an aesthetics? So Deleuze tries to do it, right? And he has a more or less realist aesthetics. And I think Larwell does it too. And so, yeah, this identity photography means that, you know, through this bizarre unidirectional clone logic, right, the world or the real can kind of produce an impression of itself. And that's this identity photography, where the print or the impression that's produced is not like a mimetic copy or like a synthesis into another medium of like, you know, chemical and pigment on papers. And it's actually a clone, like a unidirectional same copy.
Yeah. You began with invoking Bartleby and Occupy, and I sense a sort of...
Is this the capitalism question?
No, just an implicit kind of, maybe in the whole four evening event, sense that there is something to some of these ideas, this withdrawal, that is speaking to us now. I mean, this text was written in 1988, and it's, you know, arriving in New York sort of in this interesting way now, and I'm just wondering if you could maybe flesh out a little bit if you see some political resonances or ways that speaks to us.
Totally. I mean, I think that you know, I think there's sort of, you know, like kind of two main avenues, right? Like you can say that, you know, existing structures of political representation are adequate scaffoldings for, you know, struggle or petitioning the powers that be or whatever. Or you can say that they're totally not sufficient, right? Or actually, no, it's the opposite. They are sufficient, right? Larouel, his beef with most things is that they think that they're sufficient to handle everything. Right? So philosophy is sufficient to handle every question. There can be a philosophy of money, a philosophy of, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or something, right? It can be a philosophy of everything because it's sufficient to itself. So maybe the other path would be an insufficient politics, where you say, no, the existing structures of representation are not, that's not okay, right? And that's what I think the no demands thing says. Right? If we have demands, okay, that means we can speak these demands in some existing language, we can put them down on paper, we can send them to Washington, and we can haggle, you know? It's a synthetic model, essentially, right? Bargaining. Or we can basically pursue the generic. And I think the no demands is heads down the pathway of the generic or the whatever. And there's lots of different words for it. The singularity. So I think those are the two kind of political options. And I think that's why there has been this kind of like groundswell of both like activism but also theory, you know, around like these kind of new possibilities.
So, I guess I had a slightly different reading of this text, which was that, I'm really glad, I guess, yeah, first of all, I'm really glad that you brought up the Deleuze stuff, because that seems really significant, specifically that followed the essay. But also that it's about blackness, right? So, like, whiteness, white light is super significant concept for Deleuze. It is the concept. It's the concept of the concept. It's the perplex of the mixture of the colors within white at once. It's the virtual, like, you know.
Yeah.
So to me, his essay on darkness, this essay was less like a non-philosophical text as such, and more of the production of more philosophical material, specifically the philosophical material that would maybe fill up the space of a counterposition to Deleuze, right?
That's interesting.
So something like an ontology of blackness, something that might fit in like with a lot of like the black metal ontology stuff that's going on now. But
it's probably next door. It's the same number. Yeah, then just walk out in the door that's right here on the other side of the road. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. So he talks about like chromatics. Deleuze talks about chromatics. This is sort of a euchromatics. There's a lot of sort of philosophical reciprocity between these two positions, between Deleuze and this, and the Larouel in this essay. So I think it might be hasty to judge this as precisely because for Larouel, I don't think it matters what you say about anything, really, like if the universe is black, things are, or anything about the one being, all of that only matters in non-philosophy if it's posed axiomatically according to the occasion of philosophical material. So it's occasioned by these things, but it doesn't, you know, it's not an ontology. It doesn't say anything about anything. It's a process. It's scientific.
Yeah.
Philosophy is like just a phenomenon, a natural phenomenon that it, you know. So I guess it's my concern. It's not really a question, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really, it might actually resolve these issues we were having the other day about, like, why is the terminus of this essay black and not the one or something, right? Are black and the one the same? And we like, Nicole and I were talking about this the other day, and I was still kind of confused about that. But I like this reading you make, which is that maybe Lauderwell is almost kind of, yeah, as you say, kind of like fleshing out the philosophical discourse a little bit to kind of push it along and then maybe kind of seed it so that there could be a non-philosophical,
eventual.
Yeah, that's cool. You can post questions to the other speakers too.
For the mat. Thank you for having me.
And also Aaron Matei for the video, which I'll turn on now. If you haven't seen it, please take a minute to listen and watch. And also for Taku Nami and Eugene Thacker, who provided the audio installation that's been forming this exhibition for the past 4 days. So thank you to all the artists. And please join us at Toad Hall. We'll be there in about an hour.